Okay, you can't do this on network shows, but here we are. Our producer, Dave Rosenberg, just came in and said, you know what, there's so much more beautiful music. I want to try to cut this up. Just take another hour. So what are you going to do with the hour, Joseph Horowitz?
Let's start with a teaser, as we usually do.
Joe, you did it again. It's another piece which I probably should know, but I've never heard it before. What was that?
Triana by Albéniz. I'm a little surprised you haven't heard it in its orchestral version, and that's the point, that we normally or we frequently hear it in an orchestral garb that misrepresents it. Backing up, what we're talking about, the big picture, is that two Spanish composers, Albéniz and Falla, around the turn of the 20th century, went looking for Spain. Mm-hmm. They were both unhappy with Spanish music of the 19th century. They felt it had to be reconnected with the European tradition, with the continent, with Paris, with modernism. And in the case of Falla, as we've been saying, he first looked at flamenco in Andalusia and then eventually found other sources of Spanish history and tradition which he could utilize. But just before Falla comes Albéniz. And Albéniz, like Falla, is a composer underplayed, underknown, and misunderstood in the United States for a very interesting reason, which is that for years, his greatest music was best known as it had been simplified and glamorized in orchestral transcription. So this hid from view one of the most monumental achievements in the history of music for the piano, and that is his four books of Iberia, the last music he composed. Messiaen called Iberia the wonder of the piano, the masterpiece of Spanish music, which takes its place, and perhaps the highest, among the stars of first magnitude of the king of instruments. So what is Messiaen, this famous French modernist, saying? Mm-hmm. That maybe the greatest music ever composed for the piano was composed by Albéniz and is Iberia. Here's Debussy. Debussy said, there are few works in music to compare with El Baitín. This is another movement from Iberia. Although the popular themes are not exactly reproduced, it is the work of one who has absorbed them, listening until they have passed into his music, leaving no trace of a boundary line. Never has music attained to such diverse, such colorful impressions as in Iritania, another movement from Iberia. One's eyes closed, dazzled by such wealth of imagery. There are many other things in this Iberia collection wherein Albéniz has put what is best in him. And just to embellish this idea further, not only has this music been simplified in transcription, it's been simplified in performance. We know that many pianists, including Rubinstein, whom we've already referred to, simply left out notes because the textures of Iberia are among the densest and most tangled ever conceived for the piano. If you hear Iberia and it sounds soothing and mellifluous, you're not hearing Iberia. So what we're going to do on this hour with Pedro is explore what he considers to be the real Iberia. And I would suggest beginning with the other Iberia as a foil. So we're going to hear Triana, the very music we just sampled, in what was once a very famous and well-known orchestral transcription by Enrique Arbos, who was a famous Spanish conductor and transcribed five of the 12 Iberias. This is Arbos himself conducting his transcription of Triana.
Thank you.
So we've been hearing a little bit of Iberia as transcribed by Arbos, and Pedro in the corner is making faces. He's holding his head in his hands. Before you begin your diatribe, can we just hear the dense middle section of this Triana, which is typical of the knotted keyboard textures of Albanus in Iberia, and hear how they come out in orchestral garb. So let's hear what this music actually sounds like as composed by Albanus. This is a live performance by Pedro Carbonet. So what you're listening to is music that sounds like it was composed for about 20 or 25 fingers.
He didn't do that by himself. You can't. I can't believe he played so all. This is because your hands had to be up at the top of the keyboard. At the same time, you got both hands down low. Well, how do you do that?
This is the difference between Arbos and Albanus. So yeah. I now turn the show over to Pedro, who's been suffering in the corner. Tell us about the real Iberia.
Well, now I'm suffering here because to do an orchestral transcription of an Iberia piece by piano is like making a piano transcription of Ravel's Bolero. It's the same thing. You take something that was conceived for a particular medium, for a particular color, for a particular, and you just move it to a place where there is no room for that. I mean, part of the beauty of this second theme of Triana is all the texture and everything that is in between. And, you know, and you have the theme at the top, then you have it in the middle, as you are saying. You say, how can you play that in the middle if you are playing the bass and you are playing? It's all this struggle.
I know you had a third hand there. How did you do that? I'm sure that's true. I'm not sure anatomically how you managed it, but congratulations. It's a miracle.
We try all different things with pianists. We all come up with different solutions because you cannot play what is written, cannot be played. So you have to come up with solutions so that it sounds the same and you play the same notes, but somehow you
split
manage.
Split them up differently, yeah.
Yeah, you change hands, you know, we all have all kinds of tricks to each other. I've talked to Alicia La Rocha regarding this, I talked to her friends, you know, I do this, what do? I do that, it's that kind of thing, you know. But what matters here is what sounds, okay? And at the end, you have to get this beautiful sound of the piano where there has to be the struggle. There has to be the struggle for the texture, for the balance of the sound, and because that is part of the music. The music was conceived to be played like that. If you take that, if you take that score, and you give three notes to a flute, you know, three to a clarinet, and this to the violin, at the end it turns out something that is completely intranscendent. I mean, it has no meaning at all. It's like, what the hell is this? You know? So they really, really, you know, these transcriptions, they make me sick.
I know. See, but they're really good on Hollywood Hit Parade. Yeah, it sounds a little bit like that transcription. It is a very old recording to give Arbos as a due. It's a very, very old recording.
I think it's 1929.
So we weren't hearing all of the sonics.
Yeah, if you were making a movie about Spain, you know, in the 20s or in the 30s, and it was made by an American filmmaker, that's exactly the music he would put
Yeah, it sounded like Hollywood to me. But you know what? It sounded like a really good composer written this piece for Hollywood.
So who is Albanus? Yes. He is, first of all, a pianist.
Yes. He was a child prodigy, by all means. Mm-hmm. Okay. He escaped his home.
He toured a lot, didn't he?
Yeah, he toured a lot.
Including in the New World.
Yes, correct. He escaped his home the first time, I think, is that when he was 13 or 12. And he was caught in some train, you know, at some point and was sent home. Okay. So the second time that he escaped, that he was already 15, I think. Yeah, he was really old, you know. His father, who worked for the customs service in Spain, he was called, from Puerto Rico.
No.
From Puerto Rico. He said, your son is here in Puerto Rico.
There's an ocean in between.
I know. He took a boat and he went to Puerto Rico.
Wow.
And then he came to the U.S. And he was touring. He played in San Francisco and he went around.
As a teenager.
Yeah, he was 15, 16, 17. Wow. And he made a living out of it. I mean, he could support himself. So at the age of 19 or 20, he decided to settle down, you know, in Spain. But anyway, but really what characterizes Iberia is that when Albéniz was living in Paris with Falla and Debussy and Ravel and Degas and all these people who were there, you know, they used to make a little bit fun of him because he only composed salon music. You know, very shallow pieces, you know, which is everything that he composed before Iberia. Even the Suite Española, which is the one that is a little better. But the rest of the pieces, they're the salon music, which is easy to play and easy to listen to. So he was fed up with that and he said, okay, now I'm going to compose seriously this time. Mm. So when he was 50, he decided to compose Iberia. Iberia is a set of 12 pieces. As I said, they are very hard to manage. Okay, I don't think he played them. A funny story. My teacher in Spain, Maria Canals, okay, her father was a good friend of Albéniz, and they would get together, you know, and play and have fun. And he said that once, you know, just being half drunk and all that, that Albéniz was playing a piece of his. And at the end, since he didn't have any fingers left to play the last note, he played it with his nose. Literally. So this. So I didn't think that he decided that he would, you know, get even with everybody, you know, and compose something that was really difficult to play. And so much so that the story says, you know, that Falla met him walking in the streets of Paris at that point when he had just composed Lavapiés, which is piece number 9, I think, in Iberia, okay? And it's probably the hardest. You know? A piece is basically unplayable. You know, you cannot even read it, you know? And then that he was very, very depressed, Albéniz, because he said that he had composed a set of pieces that couldn't be played. And he was thinking of destroying them. Mm. So I don't know if fortunately or unfortunately for pianists, he didn't destroy them. I'm saying unfortunately, because then we wouldn't have to play them. But of course, I'm kidding. It's beautiful music. And for me, it has nothing to do with the Falla language. Okay, Falla language is more austere, stern. Albéniz is doing some concessions to the idealization of Spanish music and Spain. He composed them in Paris. They are oriented for the non-Spanish person. Uses a little bit of this, you know.
But they're still so dense that they convey a kind of harshness of their own.
Very much.
Unless you're listening to the wrong pianist or to an orchestra. Could you set up Triana for us?
Triana, the middle section, which is a famous one, is a Paso Doble Torero. Paso Dobles is what these bands play at the bull rings in Spain.
Paso Dobles is a double step.
Paso Doble, double step.
Yeah.
That's so that's what it is, actually. Okay. Mm. And Triana is a quarter in Seville. Mm. It's the gypsy quarter in Seville.
Ah.
And for me, Triana is the, you know, the Feria de Abril in Sevilla is the yearly festivities in Seville, right? For a whole week or for 2 weeks, I don't know how long it takes. You know?
So this is like Carnival, something like that?
Something like Carnival, right? And people like to go out with their horses, you know, and their girlfriends and their wives and driving in the, you know, this idea of showing off.
I'm imagining one girlfriend on one horse and a wife on the
yeah.
other.
Well, it's a kind of, it's a tradition. You yeah, know? Yeah. It's a tradition. And I'm of course, I'm exaggerating this a little bit. But, see, you know, it's this macho thing, you know, which, of course, today is different. But anyway, but you have to, it's a tradition. Mm-hmm. You know? So you kind of show off your best, you are riding your best horse, very proud with your beautiful girlfriend riding with you, that kind of thing. That's the Feria de Abril. And that's what Triana is about. For me, Triana is very much about horses. Horses that, you know, the Spanish horses that walk like legs like that, in describing circles. And that's what Triana is about. The whole piece, from beginning to end.
Should we hear it?
Yeah.
Let's. You're just a little tiny bit of a virtuoso yourself, Pedro. That's a grand flourish there at the end. Triana from Iberia of Albanes. And we got more music coming up. But before I let you guys go, here we have Angel, my old friend from many years, and Pedro in the same room. I'm going to ask you guys a question, because when I was a kid growing up and reading books about music, before I actually knew a lot of the music, I kept reading that the best Spanish music is actually composed by Frenchmen and Russians. You know, read that? And there are some very good pieces by Ravel, Debussy, Chabrier, not to mention, you know, Rimsky-Korsakov. There's some really wonderful pieces. That's not Spanish music. That's about as Spanish as the restaurant music is Hungarian music in Budapest, you know? I mean, it's lots of national color and everything, but not the real deal. So what is Spanish music, and why are the two of you so dedicated to it, aside from being hometown kids?
Well, we are still trying to discover it, actually. I mean, we are at the end of the 19th century, and that was a common concern for everybody in Europe. Everybody was trying to find their identity as a nation. And Spain was in a more difficult position than the others because, as you know, in 1898, Spain loses their last colonies,
which is Cuba.
Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines.
Right.
So this is a time for depression in Spain. Mm-hmm. That this followed at the beginning of the 20th century with kind of a silver age that all these composers bring, because they are looking for their identity actually outside of the country. So as you see, all of those composers we have been talking about today went to France.
They studied there, they worked there, they became close with Debussy, Ravel. They were adopted.
But they were still Spanish.
It
has to do with what Pedro said about the 19th century. They were kind of sick of the zarzuela being the national identity. They said, no, we are part of Europe. We have to be part of the modern language. But what is the difference between Spanish music and French music in terms of now interpretation? I think we have mentioned this before, and we want to emphasize it. The word is austerity, is harshness, is different. And if you travel to Spain, you see those differences, and you see Castilian, and you see that the dryness of many parts, you see the architecture. The most beautiful Romanesque in Europe probably is in the north of Spain. This austerity in the Escorial, of course, the Catholic religion, austerity is what this everything about. So I think this is our identity. I think we have to go back to this simplicity and austerity in everything.
Elaborating on what Angel, you know, is saying. When we interpret Spanish music, or at least when I do, and I know Angel, you know, has the same approach, I don't use aesthetical values or aesthetical ways of measuring things. We respond to music and we respond to art, I mean, human being in general, because of the emotions. There is an aesthetical factor, but I think the most important thing is the emotion that a piece of art provokes in you, more than aesthetically. You can say, well, this painting is very beautiful, has blah, 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 but it makes me, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's what we try to look in Spanish music. I think that all these versions by French composers and Russian, the people we're talking about, those versions, they are based on, they try to make the an aesthetic approach to Spain, right, in the music, right? They take that idea. But they forget the emotions because they don't know them. They are not from Spain. Same thing with me if I'm playing Russian music. I mean, I can understand the aesthetics, you know, and emotions I can try too, but I will never feel that like somebody who has been born in Russia, you know? So it's the same thing. Usually, looking at Spanish music from outside, you do it in a rather shallow way because you only look at the aesthetics. And we try to look at the emotions. And the emotions in music are not necessarily in the aesthetic, in the way, you know, to combine the rhythms with the colors, with the tempo, with many things. I mean, that's why, you know, playing music is not easy, as you know.
Well, I'm thinking the composers we were listening to today were born late 19th century, came of age in the early years of the 20th century, went to Paris, had other experiences.
Yes.
Now we're jumping ahead more than a century to the time that the two of you were growing up in Spain. How is the curriculum in the schools, the conservatories, how has that changed for the way it was since, say, 1900?
Well, I think we both are a case of disappointment in studying over there. I think our generation actually we suffered a terrible musical education.
Yes.
and we had to escape. Pedro came to the United States. I went first to Germany, and then I came here. I think now things have changed. There is
They've changed a lot.
Yeah, I think there is a new generation of musicians that have a much better. I mean, they don't need to go out to really learn well to play an instrument, etc.
Yeah, I mean, in the 70s. I mean, I was raised in the 70s, obviously in Spain. Spain in the 70s, I mean, with Franco, I mean, we were like that side of the world.
That's the elephant in the room, Bill.
Franco.
There's an elephant in this room. It is Francisco Franco.
Yeah.
We have in common a friend, Antonio Muñoz Molina, who is the preeminent novelist in Spain today. He is obsessed with questions of Spanish identity. Mm-hmm. Why? Because of Franco. And what he will tell you, and he often has participated in our concerts when we explore Albanus and Falla. In fact, more often than not, he is a participant. Hmm. And he will tell you that this birth of modernism, of modernismo in Spain at the 20th century, was cut short.
Mm-hmm.
And we do not realize the magnitude of its beginning. We don't remember that the Berg Violin Concerto was premiered in Spain, that Moses and Aaron was mainly composed in Spain, that Schoenberg was living in Spain. And he emphasizes that this rebirth of Spanish culture was prematurely terminated. So out of this period of decades of darkness, these guys are emerging and looking around and trying to orient themselves. In Antonio's opinion, the skeletons in the closet are still in the closet.
Yeah,
the door is still shut. Although we see that the new prime minister is going to disinter Franco, that's an emblematic move in the context of the chronology that we're discussing on this program.
When I was with the St. Louis Symphony, we were in Madrid, and Leonard Slatkin dragged me along to see El Escorial, which was very impressive, very interesting, and very austere. This is the burial place of the Spanish nobility for a long, long time. On the way back, our cab driver insisted that we visit Franco's shrine.
That's right.
Which is like a mausoleum. Like, it looked like a Hitler bunker times seven.
Yeah.
It was so weird. And we didn't know what to say. We're trying to be polite. Joe, you and I are too young to have been members of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, but I think our sentiments are sort of in line with that. We wouldn't have been Franco's buddies in 1936. For the young people right now, they're dealing with it because, like, you're working there. You got to have a job. You got to get along with the society. Who's running the society? Leftovers from the old regime, young people. It's a mix.
So that's a specimen of the fate of Spain, that mausoleum, which is now being reconsidered.
It is not really a mausoleum to Franco.
Yes, he never intended to be buried there, but he was.
But it's sort of a monument to everyone who's lost in the war, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the idea. That was
except idea. Not on the communist side.
Well,
so Guernica is not represented.
Actually, half of the people there are from the communist side, of the people who are interred. But I'm just saying that there are many misconceptions.
But surely the conception of the edifice itself is a product of Franco's Spain.
Sure, sure. That's
the point. And it's gargantuan and grotesque.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, before we turn away from this riveting topic, to get back to the music, because we have one more beautiful piece from Iberia. Angel, I've got to understand that you are the recipient of a very important award. Tell us about that, the Queen Isabella Award. What is that?
Yeah, it's like a knighthood. It's the order of the Queen Isabella.
Ser Mayor.
Well, we have been promoting Spanish music for many years, Pedro and I and Joe. So I'm very, very proud to have this recognition. And we will keep doing it, of course.
So Queen Isabella, that sounds like it goes back a long way.
Yes.
Like 1492 anyway, right?
Exactly.
Well, congratulations, my dear friend.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
I'm sure I've heard this wonderful music making, and never more so than in this show today, where we'll be able to hear so much of your wonderful conducting and your partner here, Pedro Carbonell. Now it's time to get back to one last piece before we say goodbye. We're going to go out with music. So let me say that you've been listening to this expanded edition of Post Classical, an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org. So on behalf of myself, Bill McLaughlin, Pedro Carbonell, Joe Horowitz, and Angel Gil Ordóñez, thanks so much to Dave Ozenberg for giving us a little extra time here to give this music of Albanus, which we might not have been able to squeeze in today. And Pedro, we got one more piece. What do you want to play before we're out of here?
Well, one of the favorite Iberia pieces by Joe is Rondeña, and it's also one of mine.
Rondeña.
Rondeña. Rondeña. Rondeña. Rondeña. Rondeña means from Ronda. And Ronda is a beautiful village in Andalusia. Very spectacular because it's like on a cliff. And then you have,
very vertiginous.
Yeah, it's very, very beautiful. And people go there, it's a very touristic attraction. Yeah. Ronda, okay? Now, and it's funny because if it's called Rondeña, it means that it comes from there, right?
But it sounds like it's a woman, Rondeña.
Well, yeah, Rondeña would be a woman from Ronda. Right. Or a piece based on Ronda, but yes, it's in feminine. But the funny thing, we get back to this thing about composers and titles, right? That you would expect that Rondeña to be based in some local gypsy song or Andalusian tune, and it's not. Rondeña is a Cuban guajira. And Cuban guajira is what we were talking about before. You know, Leonard Bernstein. That is the Cuban guajira, which is a 6/8
and
3/4.
Right.
Okay. Which is a rhythm. It was invented in the Caribbean, right? Based, of course, on Spanish tradition. Yeah. So it seems to me, I mean, I'm making this up, of course. Albéniz was in the Caribbean because he escaped to Puerto Rico, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like he brought the Cuban guajira
back with him.
Back with him.
Uh-huh.
And then he called it Rondeña, I don't know why. Okay? But, yeah, but there is a middle section.
Cherche la femme.
The middle section of Rondeña is a very nice singing part that sounds a little more gypsy than the rest. But what you have to keep in mind is the unrelenting yatata 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 yatata.
Can't wait to hear this. All right, folks, we're going to bid adieu from Joe Horowitz, from Angel Gil Ordóñez, and from my new friend, I just can reach over across here, a microphone, Pedro Carbonell. You are a marvelous radio companion, and I can't wait to hear you play out loud. But we've been loving these recordings you made for Post Classical. Have a really nice time, and here's some beautiful music, and we'll go out with this. Thank you.
The next post-classical will come your way in February of 2019, and an extended version with added material of this broadcast can be found on our website, wwfm.org, as a webcast. Our recording engineer in New York, Bill Zygmunt of Digital Island Studios. Check them out at digital-island-studios.com. Post-classical is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and wwfm.org.